he said, giving her a small smile. Whatever was growing between these two, she liked it, although she wasn't sure that Mr. Munshi would approve. But it looked like a genuine friendship, not that she would know. After her marriage, her friends had faded away, as they often did at home when a woman got married and her life began to revolve around her own home. After she got married, the closest thing she had had to a friend was Rahi. Ram met his friends at his club, and Rahi had never brought boys home, although Pivel wondered now if that was because he hadn't wanted to, or because he wanted to far too much. She followed her guide and her companion out of the hotel and into the baking heat, which felt more oppressive than it had in Phoenix, although she knew the temperatures were the same. Perhaps it was the harsh sun bouncing off every sharp angle, every hard surface and colored sign. Everything was already too bright, and it wasn't evening yet, when every step would be lit up like a fireworks display, as Pivel had seen in photographs. She was not comfortable in the city, but it was the opposite of how she had felt in Washington, surrounded by tombs. Here there was too much life, too many people who looked desperate. She could see groups walking and driving, counting their money and staring at casinos hungrily. The city tour was not particularly interesting to Pivel, as she had no desire to know more about a place she immediately hated. All the buildings looked like blocks of foam. The heat blurred everything in the corner of Pivel's eyes, and she blinked them quickly, wincing at the sand caught underneath her eyelids. The bus jolted to a stop, and suddenly Pivel, who had been rubbing her eyes fiercely, realized that they were in a small parking area outside of a massive, brightly colored "Welcome to Las Vegas" sign. All the other guests were filing off the bus, so Pivel followed them dutifully. Always dutifully, she thought, and it filled her head like a bitter cloud. She stopped at the doorway of the bus. People were waiting to have their photo taken with the sign, though she didn't really know why. She supposed it was attractive, but she didn't think this would be a moment she would want much to remember. If she hadn't wanted photographs anywhere else, she certainly didn't want one now. Rebecca and Sethia stood, looking up at her. "Are you coming to see the sign?" Rebecca asked.
"I think I would prefer not. I do not like it here," Pivel said.
Color flooded her face. She had not expressed any kind of opinion about their tourism activities before this point. She had not dictated anything at all, not even in planning the destinations. It was funny now that she thought of it. The point of the trip, the exorbitant amount she had paid, the stipulations she had made, all of this was to ensure that she was in charge of what happened. And yet she had been in control of nothing. Ronnie had told her what was done, and she had done it. Parts of it she'd liked, and parts she hadn't. And she had thought that this was the way things were, but now she knew it was the way she was. Ram had been in charge, and she had accepted it. She had never realized that had she not accepted, he could not have remained in charge. Things might have been different, and the reason that they weren't came from no one but herself. It seemed strange that her first assertion of authority came at such a stupid time in such a silly way. Pivel sat inside the bus, fanning herself, as the rest of the group took turns taking photos. They posed in strange positions, contorting their faces and bodies like dancers on a stage. She watched them smiling. She was cool and content where she was. A feeling of certainty filled her like honey slowly drizzling into a bowl. The bus departed again, through the sun-baked streets and past building after building coated with opulence and built at an increasingly overwhelming scale. The bus stopped over and over again, at this point and at that, but Pivel remained on it the entire time, resting and relaxing against the plush seats, and watching the world go by. As they were deposited back on the curb of their hotel, a Comfort Inn, Pivel actually did feel comforted. She was ready to go to Los Angeles. She would inform Sethia and Rebecca that she did not plan to see that city either, that she had other plans entirely. Until now, she had not known how she would do this, but now she did. It would simply happen. It didn't have to be difficult. She would tell them, and they would agree. She had never known how easy it was, telling people what she wanted. If only she had done it long before. It had started in the tea house with Rebecca. Or had it begun at Niagara Falls, watching the water pour over and all around them? Or back in Kolkata, defying her servants, sneaking out of the house, doing something she had never done? She felt a surge of love and gratitude for Ram. After all, he had had the kindness to die. They left Las Vegas at first light the next morning. She felt faint on the bus ride to Los Angeles, a long ride through a never-ending desert. It had been quite a while since she had last eaten. Food had made her stomach twist in knots as the mixture of fear and hope bubbled up in her more with each passing mile. It was not as if they had eaten much that was good here anyway. What a strange place, she thought, with so much space and nothing good to eat. She had agreed to a bus and not a plane because she had thought she might need more time to prepare, but now she was impatient. Every bump in the road seemed personally directed at her. Every jolt and sway of the bus only served to make her angry. Good, she thought. Better to be angry. Feeling so inconvenienced renewed her hope, and she prepared to find Rahi with a resurgence of vigor. Next to her, Sethia was sleeping. He could sleep anywhere. Rebecca was looking out the window as the same view kept passing by. She had headphones in her ears, and her mouth moved gently with whatever song she was listening to on her phone. Pivel had not known that one could listen to music on one's phone until Rebecca had shown her. Rebecca had played a sad song for her, something sweet and slow. The singer was a woman, but her voice was low, and there was so much of her in the music, so much of her pain. The new songs from home were never so simple. They included so many instruments and melodies that chased each other into new places with every verse. This was repetitive, boring almost. It reminded her of the old songs, of the hymns. She couldn't understand English when it was sung. She had felt Rebecca's disappointment when she had described the thing as nice. Rebecca had asked her why she used the word nice so much, and she had been ashamed at her vocabulary, once so rich in English, now diminishing to a few overused words. She had thanked Rebecca for sharing the song with her. She wondered if she was listening to that same song now. Rahi had been crazy for music. Every movie that came out had sent him into a new tailspin of devotion, of humming and singing the latest hit, of dancing through the house with the joy of it. Pivel had learned many songs without ever seeing the films that they were meant to accompany, just from Rahi's constant repetition. The high, piercing voices of female playback singers and their husky male counterparts had formed the theme songs of his life. She'd always been so amazed that he could remember so many things, keeping them all in his head at the same time. "It's music, Ma. It's supposed to stay in your head," he had told her, laughing at her wonder. Sometimes she would be in a store or a cab and start crying and not know why, until she realized that there was music playing, something he had loved. What did Rahi listen to with this man? Had that person been like Rebecca, forcing his own music onto her son? Had he banned Bollywood from the house in favor of sad songs with tunes that went in a circle? She forced herself to think about them together in torturous detail. She tried to imagine what they would be like in bed, but there her imagination failed her. She wasn't sure how any of that worked. She had thought about asking Rebecca, who it seemed like she might know when she mentioned Lincoln, but she had lost her nerve, and now it was too late. She thought of the most disgusting thing she could think of and assumed it must be like that. She would tell this man all the things that he was, and she would know when she died that she had done one thing in her life that was right. She would have defended her son's honor. After encountering traffic jams on the road, they reached Los Angeles by nightfall. The smog in the air hung around the city like a dirty gray halo, making everything look grimy and sad. Good. She needed no affection for Los Angeles. That night, entering her room in yet another Best Western, she nodded back to Satya and Rebecca, explaining that she would be having room service. Her voice was firmer than it had ever been, giving Rebecca no room to ask if she was sure. She shut the door and turned on all the lights. She carefully unpinned her sari from her shoulder. She gently unbound it, unraveling every layer, everything that shielded her from the world. She remembered the story of Draupadi, the princess who, when about to be stripped and dishonored in public, was saved by a never-ending series of saris winding away into infinity. She was not that princess. Her sari ended, leaving her bare. She took off her petticoat, her choli blouse, her bra, and her underwear. She unpinned and unbraided her long hair, letting the graying waves hang to her waist. She turned her eyes to the mirror, looking at her naked body. She always avoided her body. She had ignored it for years as a child, and then, as it had begun to change, it had scared her. The hair that flourished in between the folds of things, the crevices of her armpits, and the world between her legs that no one would ever tell her about. The plumpness of her breasts and the way men looked at them. The curves of her hips and how they seemed to move without her even noticing. All these evolutions had concerned her, so she had ignored them. She had grown up knowing that her body was something to be covered and concealed, or it would tempt men and doom her to shame. When she had married and her body had become the property of Ram, he had used it and enjoyed it, and stopped enjoying it, and she had rarely wondered why, because it wasn't hers anymore. It never really had been. When Rahi was born, he had needed her body too, so it had been joint property, food for one, use for another. Now it was truly hers. There was no one left to take possession of it, but it had changed. It had sagged and shifted. It had weakened and thinned. The hair had changed color and density. The breasts had shriveled and the hips had shrunk. Still, she thought, I am beautiful. I am almost done with life, and I own myself, and that somehow has made me beautiful. I am happy to be beautiful before I die. She ran a bath as she waited for her food to come. Food she would likely ignore. Ram had always encouraged her to be thrifty. It felt blissful to spend his money, to waste it. Slipping into the warm waters, she wondered how the Ganges felt to the ashes of a corpse. Was it like this? She hoped so. If she did make it to the Ganges, she would want it to be like this. This was heaven. She did not sleep that night. She kept herself from sleep, turning the air conditioning panel down to a number she did not understand because it was not in Celsius. It did not matter what it was. It made the room as cold as ice. And she lay like a corpse, still and careful, waiting for the morning. On the horizon, she watched the sun as it rose, marveling at its endurance against the smog and smoke of the city. It shone on everything, no matter what it was. It illuminated people, good and bad, kind and cruel, in the same light, with the same clarity. What a martyr, she thought, with something like contempt. The planned schedule was a tour of Universal Studios. She wasn't sure what Universal Studios was, but it didn't matter. She wouldn't be going. She wondered when she should say something to Satya as they loaded into the cab to meet the tour bus. The driver was on the phone, and to her surprise, she knew what he was saying. He was speaking in Bengali, not the Bangladeshi Bengali that Satya spoke, but her Bengali. He was from her world. It had been a long time since she had believed in a sign, but belief or no, this was an opportunity, and she would take it as she had taken nothing before. She felt the way she had the day she met Ram, the day Rahi was born. That same sense of being on the edge of something. Only this time she knew what it meant.
Hello, boss. We're going to... Satya began to say, but she was ready.
Hello, sir. Pleasant to make your acquaintance. She spoke Bengali the way she had been taught, carefully and well. We are for...
She reached for the slip of paper tucked neatly in her purse and showed it to the driver. He nodded, repeated the address once, and started driving, as Pival leaned back in her seat.
Madam?
Satya began, confused. Pival merely smiled.
Madam, that is not the place we are going.
Yes, it is. I don't care about the door. I want to go there instead.
She would say no more. They would go where she wanted to go. It was her trip. The car drove on. She thought she saw them look at each other with questions on their faces, and so she closed her eyes. They were nice, and she cared for them in a way she could not have imagined, but they were no longer important. It took them longer than she would have thought to get there, but then she did not know where they were going, and perhaps anything would have felt like an eternity, or too soon. Eventually, however, she was arriving at a house that looked small and new and flat like a village hut. Everything here was flat, she thought as she looked around. There was so much space here. It was the opposite of New York. She paid the driver with a $100 bill wrapped up in a roll in her purse. She refused change. She left the car with Satya and Rebecca still in it and walked up to the address. It matched the one on the envelope she'd received long ago, she knew. She rang the bell. It was Saturday. He would be there, she thought. He had to be. Suddenly, she wondered if he wasn't. It had been so clear in her mind. She would ring the bell or knock, and he would be there. The bastard who had taken her son. And she would know him by the sin in his eyes. But what to do if he wasn't there? Wait for him? Sit on his lawn or stand, planted like a tree? Her heart began to sink in her chest, and she struggled to feel again the power she had had, the fury, the confidence in herself. Where was her beauty, that great and terrible thing she had seen only the night before? She had felt like a goddess. Now she was a demon, or worse, a ghost.
What is happening, madam?
Satya stood behind her with Rebecca next to him. Pival had forgotten anything existed outside of the man's door. She rang the bell again. The door opened. Chapter 27 When they were driving, Beam would always ask him how he got anywhere, how he knew where things were in a city so large. Jake asked Beam about Kolkata. Didn't he know his home? Beam laughed. He had never driven before arriving in the United States, and he never looked out the windows of cabs at home. He had never seen most of the city. After learning that, Jake would take Beam to places just to see them. They had driven all around Los Angeles together, and Beam never knew where he was. Jake didn't mind. He enjoyed driving. He felt most calm behind the wheel of his car. But he did want Beam to know the city, so when driving hadn't helped, he took him running. Running was a way to know a city without a car, and because Beam drove only when absolutely necessary and badly at that, Jake thought maybe running would help. Jake wanted Beam to fall in love with the city the way the two of them had fallen in love, and then he wanted Beam to move in with him. They had been together for over 3 years. 3 years of bliss, of long mornings with coffee and the Sunday paper, and endless rounds of toast, and long nights exploring each other's bodies, and knowing they knew each other best of all. 3 years of jokes and meals and surprising things in common that they reveled in. 3 years of Jake asking for things in ways that made them seem like suggestions, not demands, and living for the weekends, wanting more, dancing around anything difficult. 3 years of Beam trying to open up more, and failing. 3 years of Jake trying to accept that about him, and failing. 3 years of each of them hoping the other hadn't noticed their failures. Jake knew that it was insane. He knew that his friends and family thought it was a mismatch. that each was under so much strain trying to change for the other. But he didn't care. This was Beam. This was the one person he wanted in the world, and Beam was worth any price. They just had to go slowly, which Jake had, and wear away the resistance, which he did. Eventually, inch by inch, they would get somewhere. He would think, as Beam lay sleeping next to him, what the next step would be, the next incremental push in the next day they would have together. It was a journey, wasn't it? Being with someone? So he took Beam running, as part of a grand plan years in the making, and prayed it would work. They ran at night because Beam ran like a duck, and worried the sleek denizens of Los Angeles would judge him during the day. Together they would run slowly, slowly down the streets of the city, getting used to this route and to that. Jake, who had been a runner for a long time, was frustrated at first having to go at Beam's glacial pace, when he preferred his own punishing strides. But at least this way he could now see the elements around him more clearly, noting the changes of leaves and flowers, the urban wildlife that peeped around the corners of Los Angeles, and the coyotes that howled at night. On one such night, he turned to Beam, who was gasping for breath beside him, and smiled.
"I love you,"
he said.
"I love you too,"
Beam wheezed.
"Move in with me."
Jake said it quickly, like it was all in one word, shattering the night with his plea. He knew he shouldn't, but some part of him screamed that it had been 3 years and it had to be now. His life had to start now or it never would. And Beam just looked at him curious, his face confused, a mixture of tenderness and distance. Jake opened his mouth, but what he would have said remained a mystery even to him, because it was at that moment that Beam gently collapsed on the pavement and died. Later, Jake would know that it hadn't been his fault, that it hadn't been anything he did, not even the running. Later, he would learn that Beam's heart attack, random, unpredictable, instantly fatal, was merely one of those things that happened to human beings. But at the time, he was sure, absolutely and completely sure, that his question had killed the love of his life. Initially, after Beam had died, Jake's friends and family had told him that whatever he was feeling was okay. He had thanked them for this meaningless statement, too dazed to do anything else. For once in his life, he didn't have the time or energy to judge himself for his feelings, a fact that would have amused him if anything could have made him laugh then. The idea that he would spend more time judging his feelings than feeling them troubled him. They must think him so selfish, he had thought, as he covered each mirror in his house. He was determined to sit a full shiva for Beam, an act that would have confused Beam, had he been there to see it. Beam had been a lax and unobservant Hindu, and Jake's knowledge of Judaism consisted of jokes made in Woody Allen movies and dishes he ate in delis. The memorial service had been entirely secular, with Beam's ashes enjoying their own seat in the small hall Jake's parents had rented for the event, and friends and colleagues murmuring their condolences as Jake sat, his eyes vacant, tears leaking out of them at strange moments, like when Led Zeppelin's 10 Years Gone started playing, or when one of Beam's fellow PhD candidates recalled Beam's use of a Bunsen burner to cook fish one night when they were working in the lab. Even Beam's advisor had come down from Berkeley, explaining Beam's research to those around him, even to Jake, who knew each component of Beam's project so well that he could have done it himself. Hearing someone else describe the biology of Pacific marine life felt so much like so many talks with Beam that he closed his eyes and let the words wash over him and opened them wet and red when they were done. That had been almost a year ago. Beam had died in November, and now it was October. A whole year without Beam. Jake hated himself for living through it. He let himself think about Beam only when he couldn't control himself, couldn't help it, which was almost all the time. He had read many books that told him this would get easier, which felt both completely idiotic and also devastating in its own way. He didn't want to feel better. Feeling better would also mean feeling less.
He didn't run anymore. Instead, he joined a gym with a pool and would spend hours swimming. And at the end, he would float, staring up at the ceiling.
After swimming that day in October, the day he realized it would be exactly a year in 1 month, he tried to drown himself in the pool, but he couldn't, and he cried into the chlorinated water. Then he drove home, parked his car carefully, and groaned as he looked at his front door.
There was a cat there waiting. It was not his cat. He did not know whose it was, but for whatever reason, the cat was waiting there, as it had been every evening for the past week, looking at him hopefully with its glinting yellow eyes. He had not fed the cat or pet it once.
Why was it there again?
He walked warily to his door, and the animal, he didn't know its sex, started meowing loudly.
As he opened his door, it rubbed his legs frantically, its body vibrating with purring. It didn't look particularly dirty or sick, but it didn't look perfectly clean like a house cat either. What did it want? He had no cat food in the house, and he had no interest in letting anyone in, let alone someone with fur.
"I'm a bad bet,"
he told the cat, as he jerked his key in the lock, letting himself into the house. The animal gave a strange little growl of delight, and before he could stop it, the cat had run into his house.
He cursed. The thing hadn't been so bold in the days before. It had gained courage slowly. He should have kicked it on the first day. Then the cat would have known where it stood with him.
Now he had the vermin-infested flea bag in his home, rubbing up against his furniture and looking at him with love. As he watched, amazed, the animal jumped on top of his counter and sat, cleaning itself with vigor.
He shook his head and walked in, leaving the door open behind him. This was outside of enough. He had lost the love of his life to a trick of the human body. Now he had a cat trying to make his clean home its new litter box. He was going to throw this cat out and drink himself to sleep, and the next time he saw a cat, he would kick it in revenge.
He walked up to the counter and explained to the cat in his most authoritative voice, his tone furious, that it would need to leave. That's all there was to it. The animal looked up at him, and Jake could have sworn, smiled.
That had been 3 days ago. Since then, he had not succeeded at removing the cat, which he had learned was female, from his home. He had chased the cat with various things, including a broom, a bag, and in one particularly low moment, a meat cleaver. The cat seemed to think this was a marvelous game until it got sleepy and bored, and looked at him with the superior way cats have, as if everything humans do is for their amusement.
It followed him from room to room. It cried for food and ate the cream he poured for it with relish.
He had set up a box with sand for it, though he realized that as soon as he gave up the illusion that the cat would be leaving, he would have to secure himself a litter box.
Lying in bed that night, alone as always, he thought about the weight of Beam beside him. When he closed his eyes, he could almost feel Beam's warmth there. No, he could feel warmth, but a small and fuzzy amount of it. He opened his eyes and saw the cat curled up next to him, her face resting on her paws.
He thought about kicking her off, but when he reached his hand out to push her away, she shifted her body into his palm and purred deeply. With the warmth of her pulsing through his hand and making him feel not alone for the first time in a year, he knew he would be buying a litter box the next morning.
He had to admit, it felt nice to wake up with something alive in the house. It felt nice that there was a pair of eyes watching him. Even when Beam had been alive, Jake had spent more nights alone in his apartment than with him. Jake was not used to seeing something living around him. He would find her a home, he decided resolutely. That's what he was doing, foster care for a cat until the right person came along for her. He was not going to be a single gay man with a dead boyfriend and a cat. His life was already too pathetic. Still, when the cat curled up to him at night as he waited for his sleeping pill to kick in, he felt a warm feeling that had nothing to do with shared body heat. It was far too easy to care about things. He hadn't cared about anything, really, since Beam had died. Nothing new, that was. He would have thought he'd forgotten how, but it was just like anything else. It came right back. Chapter 28. Looking at the handsome man in the doorway, Pivel's heart broke, and she realized that it never really had the first time, because she hadn't truly believed he was dead. But he was. Rahi was gone. If he had been alive, he would have answered the door. She was a fool for hoping for anything, but she had been a happy fool for a few seconds every day. Now she didn't even have that. She wanted to press her hand to her heart and stop it. She just stood there, looking at the man who stole her son. She would have to kill herself now, after all. But not before she had told him what she thought of him. The man at the door had brown curly hair and a puzzled frown. His eyes recognized her. He knew who she was.
"Hello," he said without a trace of inflection.
"Hello,"
she responded, her voice shaking.
"I'm Jake. You're his mother. I'm glad you've come."
He opened his door and let her inside. The cat had heralded her arrival, Jake thought, as he let Beam's mother into the house. He had never seen the woman before, not even a photograph, but he knew this was Beam's mother as well as he would have known his own. She stood straight and tall in her pure white sari, and she had his face. He had hated her for so long, hated her silence. He had hated her for being the person who made Beam into someone who would never love him all the way, someone who could never love himself. Now Jake stood aside and ushered her into the home he had shared on the weekends with her son, and the cat that he should have known was telling him she was coming. There were two people with her. He wasn't sure who they were. One of them was a short man of indeterminate ethnic identity with a handsome but hungry face. Jake was politically correct enough not to simply assume he was Indian. His skin was dark and his eyes were as well. He looked about 21 years old, and he looked like a person who had once been painfully thin. The overlay of flesh on his bones was newly acquired and suited him well. His face was firm and young, and would someday be awfully good-looking if he kept eating. Next to him was a woman in her late 20s, Jake would estimate, although he had never been good with women's ages. Her hair was up in some kind of fashionable wavy twist, and he wondered if she was Jewish too. Her eyes were dark, and they looked at him curiously. It seemed that Beam's mother had brought reinforcements. At least he had the cat on his side. He shut the door behind them and watched them walk carefully through his foyer into his living room, a large open space that looked onto the revealed kitchen. It was a good house for parties, not that he'd ever had one there.
"Won't you sit?"
He said it automatically, etiquette overriding emotion. She sat. He took a seat across from her, and the cat, after looking between them, elected to sit with Mrs. Sengupta, curling up in her chiffon skirts and dozing.
The traitor.
A thousand things to say to her ran through his mind. Accusations, an equal rights speech for all people of every sexual orientation everywhere. Even a proper introduction, with memories of Beam, how they met, how they fell in love. But he stayed silent. She was the one who had been quiet for so long, who had said nothing and done nothing. Let her talk. She was looking around his home, her eyes taking in his interior decorating.
"Rahi must have liked it here."
"Rahi?"
"Rahi, my son, Rahi Sengupta. What did you call him?"
She spat it out. He was tempted to shock her, to hurt her, to say, "my bitch," or "my chocolate dream," or "my personal Kama Sutra," or "gay Ganesh," but he didn't.
"I guess I knew his name was Rahi, but he called himself Beam."
It was as if he had spoken a magic word, because her animosity fell away for a moment. She actually smiled, her eyes unfocusing.
Oh, he didn't. No, he didn't, did he?
I can assure you he most certainly did.
Jake grew formal when he was angry.
Bhima told him he sounded like the solicitors in 90s Bollywood movies, speaking pure truths in a corrupt court. He used his lawyer voice now to lay his claim. Who was she, telling him what he had called the person he had loved?
This was my name for him. He was my brave boy, my Bhima, always ready to save me. It is from a story that we tell. He was just like that, always. As he got older, I stopped calling him this and forgot why. But he used the name. I never knew.
She smiled again as tears leaked out of the corners of her eyes. Then she frowned.
I don't understand why he would have told you my name for him.
I suppose he thought that people who loved him should use it.
He said the words deliberately to upset her, because this, at least, was true, and was fair to Beam, and was to make up for everything he could have said or screamed but hadn't.
It is not right.
He and I were in love. We were together. He stayed here with me, and he ate here with me, and he fucked here with me, and he died here with me. And you weren't there, and you don't get to tell me what right is. I don't care what you called him. The man I loved was Beam.
She didn't blink, even at the profanity.
Love like that is wrong.
Beam didn't understand. He was sick.
You made him sick here.
It is not like that at home.
Love is not like that.
She spoke as though she were speaking to a child, carefully, with the absolute authority that she was right. This must have been what Beam thought every time he looked at me, Jake thought. This soft, sweet voice in the back of his head, telling him he was sick.
Jake felt an incandescent rage fill him, and he could have laughed because it was like light pouring through his body. Love was like that for your son. He loved me, Mrs. Pival Sengupta. I know your name. I know about you. I know you are from Kolkata, and that you didn't talk to Beam once he told you the way love was for him. I burned his body. He told me that's what he wanted, so I did it. Do you want that, Mrs. Sengupta? Your son's dust? Is that why you've come? You can have it. I would have sent it to you months ago. I would have come to India myself to give it to you. Not for you, but for Beam, because it's what he wanted. And he should get what he wanted because it's the only thing left I can give him. Besides, according to my religion, which isn't being gay, by the way, it's Judaism, not that you know the difference. These ashes, these aren't important. You can have it. After all, it's all he was worth to you.
He thrust the box of ashes at her almost violently. It was a neat wooden box made of olive wood from the town of Lucca in Italy. He would have loved to take Beam there. His arm mourned the loss as soon as it was out of his hands. He realized giving her the ashes caused the pain of losing Beam all over again. But he gritted his teeth and bore it, knowing it was the only thing to get this woman out of his house. He couldn't listen to her gently spoken hate. If she wanted the ashes, they were hers. He had Beam in his mind and his heart, and she could have the dust. Beam wasn't in there. She took the box, but she didn't move. She just sat staring at it, while large tears pooled in her eyes and slid down along the ladder of wrinkles etched in her face, down her cheeks and around her chin, dripping onto the box itself. Next to her, the two people she had brought with her were staring, but he couldn't care about them. There wasn't space. He looked at her, his face flushed, pumping with blood, and his hands clenched into hard fists, his untrimmed nails biting into his palms.
"You have what you want. Now go,"
he said, his voice hard and trembling. He hated that quiver in the back of his throat, that weakness. He was already choking up, and he wanted to rip the box out of her hands, and he wanted to scream at her until she cried harder, until she made the ashes a paste with her tears. But he didn't. He just clenched his hands and his whole body tighter and tighter, pushing everything in and down and together. Suddenly she stood, and without a word she left, fled the house, running out the door, her white skirts swishing around her like a departing flock of birds. The room was still and silent.
The two strangers looked deeply uncomfortable. Well, they were not his problem. You're welcome to leave as well. In fact, I must insist that you do.
They nodded jerkily, unable or unwilling to speak. They moved their bodies awkwardly out of his home, shutting the door quietly on the way out.
The cat moved briskly around his legs, demanding to be fed.
As soon as his body stopped trembling, he looked out of the window as the cat masticated happily, rubbing her entire face in her bowl.
He had already fed her once today, he thought vaguely. She would grow fat and no one would love her.
They were still standing there on his lawn, looking lost. He opened his door.
"Excuse me, but who are you?"
He asked them politely, he hoped, trying to remain calm despite his temper still simmering. The woman smiled crookedly.
"We were about to knock on your door and ask you that same question."
"Where is..."
"We don't know."
This came from the boy with something like deep, petrified panic soaking his accented tone.
Jake hardly thought one rogue Indian widow roaming the streets of Los Angeles should be the inspiration of this much terror. In fact, it almost made him laugh.
"We were giving her a tour."
"Satya," the woman gestured to the boy, "is the tour guide and I'm the companion. Don't ask. We started in New York and now we're here. We don't know Mrs. Sengupta very well, but when we got in the cab this morning, she gave this address. I'm Rebecca. This is Satya.
So, who are you?"
Jake couldn't think of a good response to that question. So instead, he asked another one. "Would you like some coffee?"
Within 15 minutes, they were seated once again in his living room. Sans widow, sans beam's ashes, with beverages. Satya, the boy, looked down with an expression of complete despair.
Rebecca watched him nervously.
"We'll find her. Don't worry."
"How?"
Rebecca shrugged.
Satya nodded. "It's not so easy to find people. They get lost. Sometimes you never see them again. How will I explain this to Ronnie? Just now she was here, and just now she is gone. Where did she go? She ran so fast, I could not follow her.
She has money. She knows the name of the hotel. It was on the emailed itinerary, and we printed her a copy. I know she keeps it in her bag. She speaks English, although here Spanish might help more."
"She doesn't speak Spanish."
"She's going to be all right, Satya."
"I was joking. She's survived this long in the world, right?"
"You don't understand what she is like, what these women are like. They are not like you. They can't just do things."
"Maybe not, but she arranged this trip on her own, and she chose to run, and I personally would like to know why, wouldn't you?"
He nodded. They both turned to Jake. He was struck by what a strange pairing they were. This graceful woman, poised and well put together, sitting next to this small man, his shirt a loud and violent mix of plaid colors, his pants unfashionably high-waisted jeans, and his face painfully anxious, boyish, with a sweaty brow.
"Well, I guess she left because... Look, my name is Jake Schwartz, and her son, Rahi, who I called Beam, we were in love. He was my great love."
Satya's face had already begun to shrivel in disgust, and Jake stopped. He would not do this. He didn't have to explain himself to anyone, least of all this odd pair of strangers. Rebecca caught his withdrawal, and she hit Satya's arm.
"Stop it! He is one of those perverts!"
"Okay, great, he's a pervert. Just shut up! You can deal with that in your own time, okay? You want to hate gay people? Great! But keep your mouth shut here. We're in his house, and we need to find Mrs. Sengupta, okay?"
Satya pressed his lips together, angry. Rebecca turned back to Jake.
"Sorry. Go on."
Beam came out to his parents, and they rejected him. They told him never to come home. so he didn't. And he hadn't told me much about them, and we never talked about them again. Then he had a heart attack, and he died, and I called his parents. But his father hung up on me. I thought they didn't care. But she showed up today, and I knew, well, that's Beam's mom. Who else shows up in a sari uninvited? And she wants his body so she can dump it in the Ganges or whatever the fuck and pray that the next incarnation turns out straight. So there you go. More coffee? They finished their drinks in silence, with the purring cat sprawled contentedly on the counter. Rebecca thanked him, and Sathya nodded, still meeting his gaze only in short bursts, as if Jake would seduce him with prolonged eye contact. Jake couldn't summon the energy to care. He was suddenly exhausted. It felt as if a weight had been lifted off his chest, but he also felt hollow, like one of Beam's snail shells. There was one in the box with Beam's ashes, he remembered. She could have that, too. He had dozens. As they rose to go, Rebecca turned back to him. She's leaving Los Angeles in 2 days, but if she wants to come back, to apologize or anything, could I bring her? Would you allow that? Jake shrugged.
She won't want to come back.
But if she does?
He shrugged again.
A memory flooded him. It was Beam lying in his arms on the sofa, slightly drunk, telling him about his mother, about how she had been the only soft thing in his life before he had met Jake. Jake had asked if Beam was calling him fat, and they had laughed and kissed, and the night had gone on, and Beam had not mentioned his mother again.
She can come, but she won't. She got what she came for.
Pivel had not run in so long that her lungs burned like mad, and her breath came hard, and her heart felt like it would give up pumping at any moment. Her skirts weighed her down, holding back her body. She missed the days of her youth when she had run in shorts and a t-shirt and felt weightless and free. Now everything felt like it was pulling at her, and in her hands, her son's feather-like ashes were made of lead. He had given them to her. Jake, the evil person who had taken Rahi. Only he hadn't seemed so evil as she sat in the middle of his living room. She had looked around the room because she didn't want to look in his face, and all she could think was, this looks like a place Rahi would like to live. And then she understood that it was the kind of place she, too, would like to live in, with all its glorious light. And she understood with shocking clarity that she hated her home in Kolkata, and she had never known that before. And her words about Rahi's liking the place had jumped out of her. She didn't know why she would say that there was something about this life with this man that her son had liked, because clearly he had been manipulated and seduced, hadn't he? He had had wide, large brown eyes, Jake, and she could see how Rahi would have liked those two. Looking at him, all she could imagine was what Rahi saw, what love had poured from her son like milk onto this man. She wanted to hate him. She did hate him. But she realized she was looking for things to love as well, the things her son had seen. When she had told him their love was wrong, she had spoken more to herself than to him, reminding herself. But then he had given her the ashes, and she knew that she had never needed to go on this trip and confront him for keeping her son from her. Here Rahi was, hers for the taking. There was nothing that had held her from her son, ever, but herself. She had suddenly thought that she had done this trip for nothing. She could have gotten the truth about Rahi, gotten his ashes, and killed herself months ago. But she knew that she wouldn't have wanted any of that, that she was happy with the way things had been, and that she wouldn't have changed it. This epiphany had made her dizzy and nauseated, and she had had to leave. She was crying, she knew, from the new things making space in her head. They pushed out old thoughts, which turned to water and leaked out of her eyes. She was happy she had taken the trip, had come all the way here. She was happy she had been alive all this time to do so. Pivel had run without looking to see where she was going. She had run down sunny streets with small houses and then down cement sidewalks with strange faces that stared at her as she ran. But she clutched the box to her chest and kept running.
and it was only when she felt that she might collapse and spill Rahi's ashes here instead of at home that she stopped and tried to catch her breath. She found a tree off the road, and under it a large rock, and she sat down, her head tucked between her knees. She held the box inside the curve of her body between her chest and thighs. Her lungs, so underdeveloped according to so many doctors and healers, had gotten her quite a long way. Pival straightened up and felt something shift inside the box. Her heart began to race again. Had he tricked her? Was there something else in here, something to get her out of his house while Rahi's real ashes were somewhere else? Or maybe he hadn't been cremated at all? With shaking hands, she opened the box. Yes, it was the ash that came from the cremation of a body. She had seen that enough times in her life to recognize it. Nestled into it was a small plastic bag. She delicately fished it out, making sure that the ashes clinging to the sides were brushed neatly back into their box. She shut the lid and looked at the bag. It was a small shell. This must have been something that mattered to Rahi. It was something precious to him that this man, Jake, had included with his ashes to keep him company. She vaguely remembered something in some letter about snails, about his studies and his work, which he discussed so rarely that she wasn't sure whether her lack of understanding was due to her ignorance or his reluctance to explain. Perhaps this small creature had been Rahi's life, his study, the subject of his doctorate. And she never would have known if this man had not put it in the box to keep her dead son company. She could not cry more. The breakneck run with the wind in her face had dried up all her tears. Pival looked around, wondering what to do now. Suddenly she realized that she was alone, which had been, of course, her intention, but the implications of that had not occurred to her until this moment. She was alone. Satya and Rebecca were far away, and who knew where they had gone? After all, she had been the one to leave them. They could be anywhere by now, looking for her, perhaps, or maybe not. The world around her seemed to be suddenly a very dangerous place, because she was truly alone in it. Surely she should be used to that? She wondered if she should simply kill herself now. She knew the truth. She had confronted the man and taken back her son. The next step was to die. She looked out onto the hazy mess of traffic in front of her, overlooking the highway. The cars were driving quickly, speeding down the road. She could jump out into them and that would be that. She could wait for a truck, something large, and take her son's ashes and they could go away together. They could take a trip together. She had never gone anywhere with Rahi. Even this trip had been, she realized, with stunning clarity, a wild attempt to be with him, to see the country she had lost him to. When they had sent Rahi away, they never knew he wouldn't be coming back. She couldn't blame him. Not when she had seen how people were here, how easy it could be to be a person without the rigid structures of duty and the crushing weight of other people's opinions. She could not survive here, she thought, nor thrive as Rahi had. America wasn't the country for her. But for the first time she did not resent it for taking her child. America had been a much better place for Rahi to be. The trucks sprinted past on the road. Pival watched them, her body frozen. Why didn't she do it? All she had to do was walk into the path of a moving car and it would be over. She would never have to feel anything ever again. She couldn't make herself move. And then at last, she knew it was because she didn't want to go. She had thought she wanted to end her life because it was a life not worth living. This was still true. She had no obligations left in the world, no ties pinning her into place. No one she truly cared about who still existed. Nothing about her life had changed, really, since she had come on this trip. But now she was unwilling to end the pain. The pain that had changed, become a hunger. There was more that she wanted now than death. Pival turned away from the highway and walked toward the street, still clutching the box. People stared at her as they passed her in their cars. There were no other pedestrians on the roads. What a strange place this was, without people in it.
She looked out at the road. She stepped toward it and flung her hand up as she had seen Rebecca do. Her body swayed almost into the path of oncoming cars. But the taxi that saw her stopped and she got into it and told the driver where she wanted to go. When they arrived at Jake's house again, Pival realized that little time had passed. The sun was high in the sky, just starting to shift west. It was a very green part of town, she thought, where other things she had seen through the cab windows had looked dry and brown and hard. She paid the cab with money she had tucked into the waistband of her sari. Her mother had carried all her money this way, she remembered, keeping her money close to her body in a gesture of protection. Pival had always done the same, an unconscious repetition. Here she was, she thought as she once again crossed the infinite expanse of Jake's lawn, and with trembling legs returned to the doorway of his home, caught between the little gesture left behind of her mother and the nothing she had left of her son. She rang the bell and waited. He came to the door warily, like a wild animal. She held the box of ashes out in front of her like a talisman, though whether it was to ward him off or beg him to let her in, she wasn't quite sure. He looked at her and took the box, cradling it like it was something precious. This was how he had thought of her son. Something precious. The thought did not disgust her. She still did not understand what had been between them, or how Rahi had loved someone in this way. But this was the only person who existed who still cared this way for her son, other than herself. She was not as completely alone as she thought. He stood aside once again and let her in. This time they did not sit on the couch. This time he kept on walking and gestured wordlessly for her to follow. He opened a door to a room and turned on the light. It was packed full of boxes, neat cubes of plastic all labeled. This was Beams. All of it. I kept it because, I don't know. You can look if you want. See what there is. There was no one else to take it, so I took it.
It was not here?
It was in Berkeley. That was where Beam was doing his research. He had an apartment there.
She had not known this. She had not known anything. He did not live with you?
He came on the weekends. He lived up in Berkeley, though. He was close to finishing his PhD. His professors came down for the funeral. The service.
There was a service?
There were a lot of things.
They stood wordlessly looking at the boxes together. It was a sea, but a carefully organized one. What would have happened to her things had she died as she was supposed to? There would be no one who cared about her to pack away her life into boxes and keep it safe. Here was Rahi's life, waiting for her all this time. Thank you, she said it to Jake, although she meant more. She had never thought she would thank this man, and now it was all she wanted to do. May I look? Her voice wavered as she spoke, that tremble that Rom had mocked and hated so. Jake looked at her with something in his eyes like sympathy. What was he seeing in her? She hoped it was Rahi. That was the best of her, after all.
It's yours to see,
he said and turned away, moving to go. She looked at the expanse in front of her. There was nothing of Rahi left at the house in Kolkata. Rom had made sure of that, clearing his room as soon as he had died and giving all his belongings to beggars on the streets, leaving his prized possessions and childhood treasures out for the rag pickers to harvest. She had watched them scavenge through her son's early life, fighting over his baby clothing and ripping apart his books, until she couldn't stand to watch anymore, until she thought she might scream. It had been the right thing to do, Rom had insisted. She wondered what he had meant by right. May I stay? Her voice was stronger this time. She didn't want to go back to the hotel. She wanted to stay here, near all the things that were left of her son, including this man. He looked at her and hesitated.
I don't know.
Please. I am very sorry for what I said to you, and for taking his ashes. But I have brought them back, and if it is not trouble for you,
I would very much want to stay. Please.
She was not begging, but she would soon. She would go on her knees to stay here. If she wasn't going to die, she needed to see how her son had lived. He looked at her with so much pain, this man. This boy, really.